him so hard they'd ripped right through his clothing. Telekinesis was a rare power for anyone, and for a wisher, it came only after centuries of practice using unspoken wishes to manipulate the world around you. Minerva had done it in the blink of an eye, in a single heartbeat upon learning who and what she was. This was only a reminder of what Caliban was up against. It reinforced how powerful his fated queen was, as well as how much she clearly despised him. He dropped his shirt and turned away from Drummer to pace to the same window the advisor had been at a moment before. He looked out over his realm as he had 1,000,000 times.
"You'll need to feed your magic if you want those scars to heal," said Drummer softly.
But he was only telling Caliban something the king already knew. A Seelie phase magic was replenished with innocent pleasures. Food, drink, candy, sweets, even wine. Chocolate was a favorite among them. Caliban's brother, Avery, preferred beer. But for an unseelie fae, it was pleasures of the non-innocent kind that did the replenishing. It was passion that did it. And the more powerful the subject of that passion, the more magic was restored. Caliban could not help but imagine such passion with Minerva, and the power that would become his in such an act. She was like the fountain of youth to a 99-year-old man. She was the promised land.
"I am aware,"
he replied simply and with finality. But Drummer wasn't finished with the subject.
"You don't have to have Miss Tristane. Not yet. There are countless others who would sacrifice themselves to your needs, Caliban."
That was an understatement.
"And I dare say they would not consider it a sacrifice,"
Drummer added with a wink.
"I'm aware,"
Caliban replied again testily. Many mortal kings had possessed harems over the years. What Caliban possessed was unimaginable by comparison. Any female in his realm would lie down for him if he indicated with a glance that it was what he wished.
"What of Dahlia? She seems to be a favorite of yours, and the gods know she would transport into your arms if you so much as whispered her name."
Caliban pinched the bridge of his nose.
"Yes, I'm aware of that, too,"
he sighed. Dahlia and her sister Violet were two of the most stunningly beautiful women in his realm. They were Tuath Fae, rare in the extreme. Tuath were, in fact, often referred to as Royal Fae. They were the kind of women who were forbidden from ever stepping foot in the mortal world due to their beauty. It was a deadly kind of beauty. Too powerful, too alien. Things would happen in the footsteps of women like that. Dahlia was the more forward of the two, seemingly intent on securing Caliban's attentions for herself. He was well aware of her manipulations. But what did he care? He was getting what he wanted. Violet, true to the assumed shyness of her name, could have cared less about her beauty or its effect upon males. And though she would have most certainly sacrificed herself to Caliban's needs, if he'd demanded it be so, the truth was, Violet was far more interested in hiding away in the comfortable shade of a giant bunda mushroom, reading books written by mortals. It confounded him. She reminded him, in fact, a little of Minerva. Suddenly, Violet was so much more desirable than her sister. He could have her. He could have her for hours on end, and that beauty and magical strength of hers would no doubt aid in Caliban's healing. It would get him by, but... No. Caliban's brow furrowed and his gut tightened. As insane as it was, the very thought of bedding another woman was not only distasteful to the unseelie king, but slightly nauseating. He wanted his queen, damn it. Drummer sighed wistfully.
"Oh, it's true love, then. She'll be the death of you, as is often the case with love."
Caliban chose to let that comment go. It was just far too true for his tastes. His gaze roved over the vast expanses of his beautiful, deadly realm.
She is so...
His words trailed off with his wonder, and for some unmeasured space of time he pondered the woman that was Miniver. He knew that Selene was a painter. He'd heard that Miniver could sing like an angel. He was wagering, rather, that she could sing like a fae, perhaps like a mermaid or a siren. Every fae possessed a gift of some kind. For a wisher, the gift would be tenfold, as would its corresponding curse.
I am told she attempted to take her own life once,
he whispered, his voice thin with a kind of helpless awe. He hadn't meant to say the words out loud, but Drummer heard him all the same.
She would have unleashed all of her magic upon the world had she succeeded,
the adviser said quietly, a hint of bewilderment in his tone.
Death at the hands of a wisher is the only thing that can release that wish-fae's full power all at once, not unlike a bomb. The destruction would have been incredible.
Caliban had heard those rumors and stories his entire life, but he'd ignored them. It did little good to talk about wishes when none of them existed any longer, and for most of his life he'd believed that to be the case. It was like a human discussing whether or not a T-Rex would have exploded when killed by another T-Rex. Did it really matter, in the scheme of things? He'd always simply suspected that the tale was told amongst wishers as a way to keep them from using their powers against each other in knee-jerk anger. Kill me and you go down with me. An effective peacekeeper, if ever there was one. However, if Drummer said it was true, then it probably was. Caliban glanced at him. The old man shook his head.
"The world is fortunate she failed,"
he said surely.
"Vengeance needs a vessel, my boy. Anger must have its queen."
The adviser nodded once, as if to himself, and his gaze became introspective and far off as he turned away to head toward the room's exit on the far side.
"And so must you,"
he said, just before he stepped through the door, without opening it, and disappeared somewhere on the other side. Chapter 4 Cal knew she wasn't sleeping. He could feel the flux in her power even as he stood there at the foot of his massive bed in the back of his jet and gazed down at the woman who was going to be the end of him. But he chose not to say anything in order to prevent an unnecessary confrontation. They were in the air, and mortals were flying the plane, and the fae gods only knew what kind of damage she would cause if he provoked her. So he simply watched her, feeling his eyes heat up from the inside as he shrugged off his outer suit jacket, unbuttoned his shirt sleeves and rolled them up, and then pulled off his tie. The skin on his chest stretched around the wounds she'd given him, wounds that were barely beginning to heal, and that wouldn't be healed fully for years to come. But he didn't have time to convalesce. This plane belonged to the human company he'd begun years ago as a cover for his existence in the mortal world. Every king had something, some kind of cover in this realm that explained who and what they were about to mortal satisfaction. After that, any doubts were manipulated and tended to with magic, and life went on. Humans were easy that way. But the occasional mortal emergency did arise, and the timing of it was never fortuitous. Such was what had occurred that morning, and Caliban had been forced to expend considerable energy casting spell upon spell over his destined mate to keep her under long enough for him to tend to the emergency. He'd received a call from headquarters that a number of deals were very unexpectedly about to go south, and if that happened, the company would take a financial dive. It would be one that, if solved with magic, would be far too obvious. Too many people were already aware of the falling stocks. This information was traded globally. There would be no correcting human perception with fae or warlock spells this time. As president and CEO of his company, his immense charm and incredibly deft social and business skill was needed to make things right and get the company back on course. Once the band-aid was applied, he would figure out why the hell it had happened in the first place. It shouldn't have. He suspected magic, in fact, and he would deal with it, but not before dealing with more important issues. Cal's violet eyes took on the red tinge that warned of fire, as they so often did when his emotions were high and he was certain no one was looking. His gaze trailed over one of the black silk pillowcases on the pillows where he'd placed Minerva. Long, snow-white, shimmering locks of hair had spread themselves across the satiny surface, like icicles in the darkness. No one had hair like Minerva. Some had ash-blonde locks, a few Scandinavian individuals and the occasional albino, but ash-blonde hair was yellow-tinged, and when the mortal aged, it became dingy, like stained teeth. Minerva's hair reminded him of the unwritten lines of a new journal, or snow that had yet to be spoiled by footsteps. It was the shade of a dove's feathers, the very essence of what it meant to be angelic. For what felt like the thousandth time since he'd first looked upon her, Caliban experienced a sharp pang of doubt. He thought of his life, seeing it in a slideshow of dark scenes that played out before his mind's eye with systematic cruelty, and he wondered how the hell he was supposed to woo someone like the fair-haired creature in his bed. Then, perhaps due to a sudden stab of frustrated irritation and inherent kingly stubbornness, and in exactly the manner he'd sworn he would not do, Caliban suddenly said, "I know you're awake, Minerva." He cursed himself at once after speaking the words, but that was just his way. Straight into the fire with him. He was the unholy king, after all. "And," she quipped back, not even bothering to open her eyes, "did you want me to get up and cook you breakfast or something?" Her tone was filled with ice, ice that splintered into deadly shards and pierced through his nerve endings. But despite the cold tone and the sarcastic words, there was a part of Caliban that could have jumped for joy at hearing them. It was a step forward. At least the first words out of her mouth were not a wish for his violent, bloody death. He eyed her for a moment more, coming to a decision, and then took his very life into his own hands by taking things a step further. He rounded the bed and sat on the edge of it. Not quite close enough to touch her, but most certainly on the same mattress. Her power swelled. It was suffocating for a moment, and he worried about the plethora of charms he'd placed on the jet to keep it in the air should she decide to go postal. But everything held, and she didn't move a muscle. After what must have been a full minute of uncertainty, probably on both ends, Caliban took a deep breath. "Are you hungry?" This time he placed himself in check and refrained from saying what he would normally say, which was, "You're hungry, I want you to eat." Being overbearing wasn't working with Minerva. It wasn't ever going to work. He needed to get that through his head, and there was no time like the present. But when she did nothing but open her eyes, stare off into space, and shrug very slightly, his temper flared dangerously. This was why he normally just insisted on things. It bypassed the stubborn bullshit altogether. Still, he reined that in, too, and said, "There is a hollow box on that counter there." He gestured with a nod to a simple black box that measured approximately a cubic foot. It rested on the counter against one wall in the plush bedroom of the private jet. Beside it were a small refrigerator, a microwave, and a cupboard of dinnerware for normal human appearances. "The hollow box will provide any food you like," he explained. Hollow boxes were fairly rare in either of the main Fey realms, as they were a goblin invention. Damon Croy, the Goblin King, had gifted this particular one to Caliban for winter solstice years ago. Avery had always been secretly jealous of it, and as it was in his nature, Cal was not too secretly quite pleased about that. All one needed to do to use a hollow box was imagine what food they'd like as they touched the lid of the box, then pull off the lid, and that food would be waiting for them inside. It worked for drinks as well, taking everything from temperature to consistency into account. The result was always nothing less than perfection. He was hoping it could serve as a sort of peace offering, or a beginning. There was a very long pause, in which time Caliban thought of a million different terrible things she could do at any given moment, and that he would have to do in response. And then, finally, like a soft sigh of breeze on a hot, humid night, Miniver shifted, turned her head and looked up at him. Eyes like midnight searched his, and for a moment he could have sworn he saw galaxies spinning in their depths. They were the impossible indigo that did not exist in reality, that kind touched by purple and embraced by galactic light, a shimmery, glowy kind of deep, deep blue that seemed well and truly endless. He was lost at once. Whatever he'd been about to offer, whatever he'd been planning to say, anything he might have only a second ago been prepared to cast upon her, at once slipped away as he floated, trapped in that miasma of wonder.
"Can it make pastel rainbow meal crepe cakes with whipped cream frosting and fine strawberry compote?"
To say her sudden and quietly worded inquiry took him by surprise would have been the understatement of the millennium. It was unexpected in the extreme. For several moments it actually left him speechless, but that was okay, because it took him that long to process what it was she was asking for. Of course the hollow box could make her rainbow meal crepe cake, whatever the heck it was. It could make anything she wanted. But the fact that she was asking him for it in the first place made him want to stick his head out of the jet plane window, loss in air pressure and all, and hoot at the top of his lungs like a lovesick moron. But he kept himself together with impressive and practiced expertise, turning slightly away so she couldn't see him smile. Then he made his way to the counter, took the box, and went back to the bed. He held the box up in offering. It weighed almost nothing, as much as an empty gift box, no more.
"Why don't you see for yourself?"
he suggested softly. Miniver watched him in very quiet contemplation for a moment, before reaching up and taking the box from him. To be on the safe side, he then retreated to lean against the counter, where he crossed his legs at the ankles and his arms over his chest. She continued to watch him for some time, the wariness in her eyes a combination of outright distrust and slowly simmering fury. Her parents had been murdered after all, and despite the fact that he'd made it clear to her earlier that there was no one left alive who was responsible for the timed trap left for them eons ago, she very understandably wanted revenge. Revenge flowed through her blood. It was the very basis for Wisher magic. At last she looked away, releasing him from his simultaneous apprehension and hope. She placed the box on her knees, stared at the top for a second, and lifted the lid. A wonderful aroma drifted toward Caliban, and he found himself rising off the counter, his neck craning to gain a peek into the box. Miniver made it easier on him when she reached inside and pulled out a plate containing what looked like a massive wedge of pastel rainbow. The layers must have been 50 deep, nearly as thin as paper, interspersed with layers of very fine white that smelled divine. The color gradation was more perfect than anything he'd seen created by the fake cooks of his realm.
"That's rainbow crepe cake?"
he found himself asking. Miniver gazed steadfastly at the aromatic pastry for some time, and Caliban was well and truly lost as to what the woman was thinking. The expression on her face was completely unreadable. Her lips parted, and in the softest of voices, which he could now recognize was raw from screaming and crying, she said,
"It is. I've never actually seen it in person."
She swallowed hard enough for him to hear it, then continued,
"I've only ever seen pictures, on Pinterest and stuff."
She looked up at him, and when her eyes met his this time, a part of him, a part that had at one time been hard and cold and unyielding, uncurled and softened and died a little then and there.
"I've always wanted to taste it,"
she told him. Caliban had no idea what to say. Her complete and utter honesty in that moment, Her fragile openness and suddenly delicate nature reminded him of diamond bubbles, as hollow as the hollow box, and were just as wondrously surprising. The future Unseelie Queen licked her lips, tentatively, uncertainly. Then she moved, turning on the bed and lifting the plate of cake slightly toward him. She shrugged a little, and that raw voice asked,
"Do you want to share it?"
Chapter 5. When everyone had finally finished coming into the meeting room on the 65th floor of the Sears Tower, by portal or front door or transportation, and taken their seats at the massive polished oak table, Roman knew that his instincts had been correct. There were only 12 kings at the table that night. There were 4 queens, 20 seats, 9 on each side, 1 at each head, only 17 of them taken. Of course Caliban's absence was both understandable and excused, as was Miniver Tristane's, his queen. So was Diana Croy's, an expecting mother on the verge of labor, as fey gestation periods were surprisingly fast compared to those of mortals. Their absences weren't what had him worried. It was the spell he'd cast prior to calling the meeting in the first place that troubled him. It verified the High Witch's claims, but he'd been a fool to doubt her, even for a second, and from where she sat at the opposite end of the table, Lalura Chantel's stern gaze brooked no recourse in reminding him of that fact. Never doubt Lalura Chantel. Lesson learned. However, this was hard for Roman. They were the 13 kings. There was not supposed to be a force on earth strong enough to penetrate their loyalties, much less turn them against one another. And yet here he was, staring at the evidence to the contrary. The 13 kings were too powerful for any spell to work in a more accurate capacity amongst them. When Lalura had approached him with her news, they'd worked together to create a spell that would have a chance at working at all. The 13 were enormously powerful, and that magic permeated any space they occupied to the point that there was a miasma of magic in the air, filling every nook and cranny, alleviating all sense of normalcy to the point that the beginning of one man's magic and the end of another's simply couldn't be deciphered. They were frankly the most powerful men in the realms, gathered together in a single room. It was quite literally magically overwhelming. But as offspring of a warlock and an Akiri, vampires possessed magic of their own. Roman skills in the art, combined with Chantel's perplexingly immense capabilities, alas managed to procure a spell that would not necessarily give them the exact answers they required, but would at least verify their concerns. They'd settled on an aura. As a mortal's aura changed with intent and emotion, so would the aura in the room. It was the best they could do. Now Roman gazed rather dejectedly at only the vaguest proof that deception sat among them. The opposing magics of everyone in the room also caused the spell to lag, so that it could not be pinned to any one king's arrival or entrance, further complicating the situation. It took a few minutes for the darkness to arrive, and he had no indication of who was causing it. But the fact that it had come to fruition at all was devastating enough. Roman's heart sank to know that the worst scenario they could encounter had actually come to pass. There was a traitor among them. One of the 13 was not on their side. The men and women at the table watched him in a strange sort of silence, as if they could sense that something enormous was occurring and was about to be revealed. His gaze trailed over each and every one of them. To his left sat his queen, Evelyn. At the moment she watched him with knowing apprehension. She'd been with them since Lalura had arrived, and was well aware of what was happening. She also knew him well by now, and can read the expression on his face. She knew he'd learned the worst. Her brown, gold-flecked eyes were large in her beautiful face, their gold highlights made more intense with her vampirism. He gazed upon her, feeling the warmth in his chest that he always felt when he realized that she was his, that he had turned her, that she'd wanted him to. No man's luck would ever be greater than his. He tried to give her a reassuring look, wanted to put her quick, comprehending mind at ease, but for the first time in a very long while he simply did not have it in him. There was too much that was wrong. So instead he looked away. To Evie's left sat the Phantom King, Thanatos, dressed in the black leather jacket and jeans that signified he'd come directly from his job the moment he'd received Roman's message. Thane was good at knowing when things were serious. A man who worked with wrongful deaths for a living would come to recognize deadly situations when they occurred. Roman considered this man, who had so long been a close friend, and his gut clenched. Was it possible that Thane could have turned on them? That any of them could have? On one level, Roman himself couldn't comprehend why this was so difficult for him to accept. They'd been betrayed by one of their own before, after all. Two, in fact. The former Warlock King had been a bad seed, as had the former Akiri King. Maybe it was something about the nature of warlock magic, and all who were born or drawn from it. Like vampires. Roman suppressed an all-too-human shiver and continued to peruse the people at his table. To Thane's left sat his queen, Siobhan. Speaking of warlocks, she was one such creature of immense capabilities. So immense that her power had drawn out the evil in the former Akiri King. To her left sat the newest member of their burgeoning court, and the latest addition to this ever-expanding table. Celine Tristane looked nervous. She looked uncomfortable and uncertain. Roman couldn't blame her. If he'd been seated in her chair, he would have been nervous and uncertain too. Celine's sister was out there somewhere, in some unknown state and capacity, dealing with an immense amount of anger and power she could not control. She was with a man Celine did not know, but for the fact that he was, for all intents and purposes, her future brother-in-law. Family in and of itself did not make ties strong. Celine had no idea what was going to happen to her twin, and she was still reeling from her parents' deaths herself. There was a vast store of vengeful magic inside that girl. Roman could feel it from where he stood. He could only imagine what Caliban was dealing with at that time. To Celine's left sat her king, the Seelie King, Avery. He looked nervous too. Again, Roman couldn't blame him. Beside Avery sat Daemon Croy, the Goblin King. His queen was currently absent and out of commission, as their triplets were due to arrive any day. Also, there was the reality that Diana was admittedly better at running Croy's kingdom than he was. The goblins took a natural liking to her and had been steadfastly loyal and supportive since she'd taken her throne, a courtesy they had very much not shown their king. To Croy's left, then, was an empty chair. But on the other side of that chair sat Stephen Lazarus, the Akiri King. Lazarus had once been an exceedingly good police detective among mortals, but had taken the position of Akiri King, otherwise known as the Demon King, when he'd been murdered by the last sovereign of the Akiri Nation, and had shown up in Thanatos's realm as something a bit more than a mortal ghost. It turned out he'd been a born Akiri all along, and when he killed the Akiri King, he rightfully took his place as lord of his kind. Akiri were an odd and special breed, born of sheer magic. In fact, they fed upon magic for subsistence, and hence had over the years developed a symbiotic relationship with some of the most magical of the supernatural creatures, the warlocks. Warlock magic had to be freely given to an Akiri. In exchange, Akiri served warlocks as would employees. It was only that their paychecks consisted of power rather than money. Not that there was much difference in the mortal world. As their king, Lazarus was the sole Akiri capable of taking magic, without asking for it. Had he wanted to, he could have begun feeding upon warlock magic right there and then at that table. He had, after all, two of the biggest potential donors sitting at that table with him. Since he'd become king, Lazarus had brought the Akiri nation under long-awaited and steadfast rule, tending to issues other kings had let slip, and bringing order to a species that had become as lost as sheep in the realms and rules of the supernatural. Lazarus had yet to locate his queen, so the seat to his left was occupied by the next king on the list, Christopher Skorl, the Winter King. Roman watched the air frost in front of Christopher with every one of the king's breaths. The man's eyes were the color of ice, and his hair ranged from dark blonde in the early spring to the blue-tipped white of icebergs in the dead of winter. At the moment he was simply blonde. If it were longer, he would very much have resembled a well-dressed and groomed Viking from one of the Northlands he so often frequented. If Christopher wanted, he could have dropped the temperature in the room by 100 degrees in a matter of split seconds. With a cold glance at the window, he could have forced a blizzard to overtake Chicago. The glass would have shattered, and rime would have coated every inch of their meeting room in sheer heartbeats. A short time later, most life in Chicago would either be dead or hanging by a thread, and it would take very little for that winter to spread. Christopher was an untapped potential for enormous destruction. But in that way he was like the A-bomb. It was too much destruction, with too many innocents in its path. In essence, it was largely unusable. The Winter King also had yet to locate his foretold queen. Therefore, beside him were two empty seats, which had been reserved for the Unseelie King and his future queen, should everything turn out in their favor. Across the highly polished table from these empty chairs were seated the two most enigmatic men to occupy places amongst the 13. The first was the Shadow King, who went by the name Kieran Pitch. Rather, it was Mr. Pitch to any one of his thousands of employees. Pitch was a very, very wealthy man. It seemed that working in the shadows and over vast reaches of time was not only beneficial for vampires, but for anyone who could pull it off with some degree of fortitude and intelligence. Pitch normally wore a suit to the meeting of the 13, but there were times when punctuality was necessary, that he was pulled directly from his realm and into this one without having a chance to change. Unlike the majority of the other sovereigns at the table, Pitch was unable to use most types of magic. Simply snapping his fingers or waving his hand or speaking a few cryptic words would not outfit him in the finest tailor-cut clothing. Nor would it transport him from one location to the next. He needed the shadows for that. That was where his power lay. There, in that darkened realm of indistinct lines and endless possibilities, was where his power became vast indeed. At the moment, the Shadow King was draped in the protective shade of a simple, though most likely exceedingly expensive and designer black hoodie, which he'd pulled up and over his head. From beneath its modern-aged cowl, his eyes glowed iridescent and strange. In his native darkness, the Shade Lord's eyes were akin to the reflective eyes of an animal's in moonlight. But glimpsed during the day and in direct light, they were as black as his hair, except where they were graced with thin, cold grey rings around their pupils. His colouring was fair enough that those eyes were stark in his handsome face, giving him the kind of hungry appearance that would have made the average passerby on the street believe he was some sort of model, or perhaps a rock star, incognito. The Shadow King had yet to locate his queen either, and hence beside Kieran sat the other of the two most mysterious men at Roman's table, the Time King, William Balthazar Solon. This was not his actual name. The Time King had no actual name, but had gone by Solon between friends for millennia. He'd added the other two names over the years, as fads directed. Of the lot of them, the Time King had once unarguably been the most powerful, but ironically, that was long ago. In the eons since then, the quietest among them, referred to as the Lone King, in closed quarters, had not manipulated the laws of physics in any supernatural capacity whatsoever, not even once. Years and experiences chased the king's heels, dogged and relentless. Stoically he remembered, and sat in silence amidst the swarms of ghosts that made up the moments of his very long, long past. No one had lived longer. In essence, the Time King sat at the table for two reasons. One, it always helped to have history on your side. That way mistakes were never repeated. And two, there was always the possibility that he would one day wield that power again. If he did, he would hold heaven and earth in his grasp. Arrak, the Dragon King, sat beside the Time King, his green eyes burning with green flame, the scar on his cheek more pronounced than ever. He was agitated. These were sure signs. No doubt he too could sense the odd foreboding in the room. Beside Arrak, who also had yet to find his queen, sat the Gargoyle King. The Gargoyle King had been a difficult one to get a hold of lately. He'd been very busy in his own right, ruling over a species of beings that were divided amongst themselves. As was usual for the 13, Mason Rushmore was one of the oldest gargoyles to walk upon the earth. Whether he was the very oldest or not would always remain an unanswerable question. Stone was simply ancient. Gargoyles were formed when enough inherent magic soaked the stone beneath sites where such magic was cast. Eventually, that moment of magical inception became impossible to date. Not all gargoyles had last names. They could choose to adopt them or not, but if they did choose to do so, they always used the name of the location from which their stone originated. Hence, Rushmore, which was a mountainside site apparently used for magic long, long before it had been defaced with the faces of human heroes. Mason had created the Gargoyle Dynasty eons ago, putting into place a court of rulers and an army of Montem warriors to protect his people. The Montem were fashioned from the stone of mountains, their blood made of pure liquid will, otherwise known among gargoyles as Mercury. Males and females were equal amongst the gargoyle nation, as there was no difference in the toughness of rock between the sexes. However, ages ago, a rogue faction of gargoyles broke away from the dynasty, bent on seeing gargoyles to an era of strong males and slave females. During their coup breakaway, nearly 2,000 male gargoyles had escaped into the intricate underground passages of the planet, and they'd kidnapped a large number of dynasty females to secrete away with them. Mason had been searching for these lost souls ever since. But tracking stone was worse than difficult. One need only imagine searching for signs of cement on a sidewalk to comprehend such difficulty. Recently, there had been a lucky break in their hunt for the rogue gargoyles. A stranger had brought them news, and the last Roman heard, the information had been dead on, giving Mason and his men a leg up they'd never before had. Hence, having the Gargoyle King there at the table that night was fortuitous indeed. The man most definitely had other places to be. The next two seats at the table were empty, reserved for Caliban and the Queen. Everyone at the table desperately hoped he managed to win. Everyone that was but the one amongst them who wanted exactly the opposite. Whoever that was. On the other side of these empty reserved chairs sat the Shifter King, Darius Walker. Walker was another of their number whose services were rarely called upon, for various reasons, but who might one day prove an extremely powerful ally. To say shifters were dwindling in numbers was to understate the matter to a grotesque degree. Human hunting and the encroachment upon shifter land had shaved their kind nearly completely off the planet. Their straits were even more dire than those of the werewolves, who had for years been tracked down and destroyed by a fanatical faction of mortals known, quite literally, as the Hunters. There were not many of Walker's people left to turn to, and they were spread far and thin across the globe. But if push came to shove, and there was no longer any choice in the matter, Roman knew he could count on the Shifter King to pull them all together for one final battle. At least, he hoped he knew this. The spell that hung over the room like a miasma was forcing him to doubt everything. He didn't like it. Beside Walker sat Chloe Septeran, the warlock queen. She was an Akiri, one of the first ever created, and one composed of a special kind of magic. Stardust. Her symbiotic relationship was a little more personal than most Akiris, as she absorbed her power and life essence from the man seated to her left, her husband and king, Jason Albrecht. Roman met the warlock king's glowing emerald gaze and knew that Albrecht was well aware of the spell Roman had cast on the room. No doubt he'd sensed it the moment he'd stepped in. It was warlock magic, after all. The curve of Albrecht's lips told Roman that the warlock was just a touch amused at the spell. But the depth to his gaze told Roman he was also concerned. These messages went unspoken between them, before Roman straightened where he stood at the head of the table and cleared his throat. Lalura Chantel sat at the opposite end, stoically watching him in that silent, cat-like manner to which she showed such proficiency. But he could feel her hold her breath. He could feel everyone do so. "I called you all here today as the bearer of unfortunate news." In any other company, at any other table, the listeners would have taken that opportunity to fuss in their seats and murmur amongst themselves. But the kings and their queens remained silent and still, waiting. "Not everyone at this table is what he appears or claims to be," Roman continued softly. There was no need for him to raise his voice. "I am afraid our meetings are no longer secure." The table yet remained still, even under this news. So Roman finished with a deep breath and a sense of bewildering loss. "There is a traitor among us." Chapter 6. Now the kings and queens did move a little, their heads turning slightly, their gazes sliding from Roman to the other members at the table. The silence became pregnant with a number of baffling and nasty sentiments, unspoken questions and accusations, and most of all, the same loss that filled Roman with empty uncertainty. This went on for some time, and Roman wondered what they were all thinking. If he'd been capable of reading any of their minds the way he could a mortal's, their problem might have been solved then and there. At last, one of them broke the silence.
"I think it's Albrecht. You can never trust a warlock."
It was Siobhan Ashdown, Thane's queen, who'd spoken, and she'd done so with a wry smile. She was perhaps the single person at the table capable of making such an accusation lightly, seeing as how she herself was a very powerful warlock.
"Right back at you," said Albrecht with a smile. "But if you ask me, it's Lazarus," he continued, his tone laced with only the slightest hint that he might be teasing. He turned, and his gaze narrowed on the Akiri king. "You can never trust a cop." His green eyes glittered like gemstones. Lazarus's head cocked slightly to the side, and he smiled. He laced his fingers together on the table, leaning slightly forward. "Don't make me eat you, Albrecht." Someone at the table was unable to muffle their laughter, and because Roman knew him so well, he recognized the chuckle as having come from the Phantom King, Thanatos. He shot Thane a hard look, and Thane cleared his throat and sucked in his lips. Clearly, the men had decided to make this terrible news a laughing matter. Roman could emphasize with the sentiment. Sometimes you either laughed or you cried, or in the case of the kings, killed someone. They'd obviously chosen the former. Roman decided to bring the meeting, such as it was, to a close. "From here out, play your cards close to your chest, gentlemen. We are attempting to pinpoint the leak." He wouldn't tell them who was busy casting spell after spell, trying to find the source of betrayal amongst them. That would be as good as signing the spellcaster's death warrants. Simply letting them all know that it was being dealt with was good enough for now.
In the meantime, watch your backs, and trust no one. I'm sorry, he added, because he felt it was needed. You're dismissed.
They all looked at him then, and some of them smiled wryly. Trusting no one, of course, meant they shouldn't trust him either.
Gotta go, said Mason suddenly, as if the roof hadn't just been dropped on them all.
He pushed out his chair and stood to his full 6'3" height. His grey and gold ringed eyes glinted as hard as steel and amber when he nodded respectfully to Roman, and then stepped back from the table.
He snapped his fingers, creating a sound like two boulders being slammed against one another. There was a brief cloud of talcum-like dust, and the Gargoyle King was gone. A trickling sound, such as you'd hear from a faucet into a bathtub, drifted away as the cloud settled. Once he'd departed, the others began to follow suit, each leaving in their own dramatic manners, except for the Time King, who simply used the door, until Roman was once more alone with Evelyn and the unusually quiet Lalura Chantel. This was the first meeting the High Witch had ever attended in which she hadn't had her fair share of things to say. She'd simply listened and watched. And now her silent, contemplative visage was fixed intently on something behind Roman, as was Evius. Roman frowned and turned around to face the floor-to-ceiling windows that looked out over the Chicago night beyond. A cat was on the other side of the glass, on the 65th floor of the Sears Tower. It was a large ginger cat with short hair, one white spot on its shoulder and one white foot. It was balancing expertly and impossibly on the thin ledge that wrapped around the centers of the windows, hundreds of feet in the air. There was a stiff wind out there, Roman knew, but the feline seemed untouched by it. It simply sauntered across the window until it reached the edge. There it stopped, sat back on its haunches on a ledge that should not have been wide enough to sustain it, and turned to look into the room. Roman's gaze met the cat's. Piercing yellow-gold eyes seared into his brain and then into his soul. Something inexplicable moved between them, as if there were waves connecting them, and a transmission had traversed the space. And then the cat looked away, got back on its paws, and continued around the corner. Out of sheer curiosity, probably, Evie very quickly stood up and raced to the adjacent windows and craned her neck.
"He's gone," she said softly.
"He was never there to begin with," said Lalura.
There were times in life when there were so many things to say, your only real choice was to say nothing. If you tried to do otherwise, then all of the words belonging to all of the questions would all come spilling out at once, and it would be like verbal vomit. Nothing would make sense. Speaking would be pointless and probably embarrassing, and quite possibly irrevocably damaging. So it was best to just remain quiet. Now was one of those times for Minerva. It wasn't that she didn't know how to handle adversity. She'd been handling it all her life, in a manner of speaking. No, she wasn't beaten as a child, she'd never been raped, and she didn't have cancer. But in a way she had been beaten as a child. She had been raped, and she was deathly ill. Because for some reason she'd felt these agonies when they'd occurred to others, as if they were her own. No one could comprehend this, no psychologist, no therapist, no psychiatrist. Everyone she'd ever confided in about this strange pain simply assumed she was acting, or that she was faultingly far too sensitive, or that she simply wanted attention, and usually a combination of all three. But now she knew. She knew they were all wrong. She knew the emotions and even sometimes the accompanying physical pain were very real. And she even knew why. It was all very real to her because she was a wisher. She had no choice in the matter. Anger was to be her life's blood. And she supposed that over time, a soul just got used to sucking up nasty surprises and dealing with them the best it knew how, because that was what she felt her soul doing now.
It was going over the new knowledge she'd acquired and dealing with it, processing it, accepting it. She was a pro at this. The one kink on her experience, the one contingency her soul could not fit into its practiced scheme, was the man who sat across the room from Minerva. In a large leather-winged back chair that was part of the luxurious decor of a bedroom in an enormous jet that at that moment soared high over the United States of America. He was beautiful, and she knew why, too. She knew who he was. With his 6-foot-whatever tall and supernaturally strong frame, and his slightly accented voice that automatically reminded her of evil men dressed in black with master plans. Minerva's knowledge of the Fae world was now as vast as it would have been had her Wisher mother raised her and her twin sister in the Fae worlds from the get-go. She had both worlds in her repertoire now. The man sitting across from her, taking oddly tentative bites of the rainbow cake, but clearly enjoying it, if the look on his gorgeous face was any indication, was no other than the Unseelie King. What she didn't know, what she couldn't figure out, was why the hell he was there with her now. Why was he bothering with her at all? Of the two realms, the Unseelie was definitely more work to rule over. The Unseelie, or Linan, as they were sometimes called amongst their own, were an unruly bunch. Not motley, just unruly, in the strictest sense of the term. They were beautiful, they were powerful, and they were selfish. They were talented, secretive, devious, and deadly. Their king was supposed to be the worst. He was also the single man capable of uniting such a world under a single sovereign and his rules. It must have been like one rider taming a million wild horses. Yet somehow he managed to do this. It left little time for other pursuits. So the fact that he'd focused upon Minerva, a single fae amongst countless, was confounding. Maybe he was terrified of her. The fae tended to feel that way toward wishers. That was why they'd wiped out her kind thousands of years ago. Maybe he wanted to wipe her out too, and her sister. The thought made Minerva's chewing slow. She looked down at her own slice of pastel rainbow layered cake, and considered this. If he wanted to kill me, he would have done so already, she thought, because he'd certainly had the opportunity, and she knew he had more than enough power. But instead of using a spell of death against her in the streets of Oxford, he transported her away. And rather than destroy her when she'd been about to attack him again in that forest next to the bonfire he'd created, he'd simply put her to sleep. He could have killed her then, too, when she was defenseless. But here she was, sitting alive and well, and eating cake, of all things, on his bed in his personal private jet. Okay, so he doesn't want to kill me. What then? Did he somehow feel responsible for her? Did he consider her a dark fae and under his rule, an Unseelie? It had never really been determined which realm the wishers belonged in. They were empathetic, sensitive creatures, and that would have lent them more toward the Seelie end of the spectrum. But their capacity for such deadly and severe magic would have tilted the scale and slid them more toward the Unseelie end. They'd all been murdered before anything was decided once and for all. Minerva put down her fork and took in a deep, slow breath. The release she'd experienced in Oxford was a mixed blessing. She'd never felt so much pain, and the culmination of it all at once was the trigger that had set her transformation in motion. But now, as she stared down at her half-eaten cake and tasted the remnants of it on her tongue and felt a little thirsty, she realized a lot of the pain had subsided, going as quickly as it had come. Her adoptive parents were dead. But they hadn't been young, and her father had been sick, and her mother had been suffering more from that sickness than he had. There was something else, too. They'd decided to come back to Oxford at exactly this time. The decision had confused Minerva and her sister, but now Minnie wondered whether they'd known. whether they'd made the choice to return to where Minerva and Selene had been adopted because they'd wanted her to learn about her birth mother. Because they'd known they were going to die. Did people know sometimes? Minerva felt that they did. Sometimes. It must have been a salve on Minerva's emotional nerve endings, because most of the pain was gone just then. More than anything, she was now curious. A little cautious, and a good bit afraid. She glanced up at the dark, powerful man across from her. He met her gaze. And she quickly looked away. She couldn't help it. Being trapped in that gaze was like... It felt like drowning in shadows filled with pixie dust and powdered sugar and bubbles like the ones from the labyrinth. She could lose herself forever in those eyes, and she wasn't ready to do that just yet. But at least she knew what she wanted to say to him. Her brain seemed to focus, calm itself down, and slip into some discernible pattern. She licked her lips and asked, "What am I doing here?" It was best to just be straightforward with her questions, she decided. Hopefully his answers would be as much so.
"What do you want with me?"
Chapter 7 Caliban could scarcely believe how good the cake was. In all honesty, he rarely ate sweets. He was a busy man, and he didn't need to consume mortal food to survive anyway, so he did the things required to keep up appearances. The occasional glass of wine or brandy, the shared beer or cup of coffee, the appetizer snippets at a formal dinner, and that was about it. Still, he had lived a very long time, and given enough piled-on days, he was bound to have tried just about every kind of food on a planet. So it was with some surprise that he realized he'd never before tried this. This rainbow cake deal, or whatever it was she'd called it. It was even more surprising that he enjoyed it as thoroughly as he did. The hollow box didn't just give you the food you asked for. It read your mind and recreated what you truly imagined and desired. So whether rainbow cake normally tasted this good, Cal couldn't be sure. But what Minerva imagined it tasting like was really damn good. It exploded with a variety of harmonious flavors in his mouth, melted a little like ice cream upon his tongue, and was just creamy enough to leave him craving the next bite. He was shoveling another large bite between his lips when Minerva's soft, sweet voice broke the humming silence in the room and stilled him mid-bite.
"What am I doing here? What do you want with me?"
Caliban's entire body froze. It was a rare thing for him to be taken by surprise, and this slip of a woman with hair like snow and eyes like night had been doing it left and right. "What do I want with you?" He swallowed hard. And then the plane bucked several feet and Minerva gasped. Caliban rose to his feet and set his plate aside. His instincts sharpened, his hearing honed, and his magic unfurled itself, reaching out on unseen arms like antennae. The plane bucked again, this time dropping a dozen feet before it caught itself once more. The sudden dip sent Minerva sprawling across the bed, where she gripped the headboard. Fortunately, it was attached to the wall. Caliban automatically steadied himself, his magic wrapping itself around him as it always did, and easing him gently off the ground until the jet had once more righted itself. "Take my hand," he said, striding across the room to the bed and offering Minerva his outstretched hand. Something was terribly wrong. The pilot was dead. He could sense this. The plane only flew now because Cal was controlling it with his own power. Whatever had taken the pilot's life was laced with familiar energy. Cal recognized it because it was so similar to his own. It was dark. That was enough. That dark energy permeated the cockpit and was growing. There was no telling how strong it would become. Caliban was the most powerful man in the Unseelie realm, but he was neither so arrogant nor naive as to believe there might not be a magic out there stronger than his own. There was Minerva, after all. As his queen, she was almost certain to become more powerful than he was. It was entirely possible the energy in the cockpit would overpower his own strength any moment now. Then Caliban would not be able to protect himself or his mate. His only option was to transport out of the plane and then destroy it himself before it could hit the ground and harm anyone else. Minerva looked down at his hand, and showing a good deal more